Today is October 23rd. We're meeting in the Marist College Library. The interview this morning is with Jim Fay. He's an adjunct professor here for many years, recently retired. He's a former IBM full-time employer. Thank you, Jim, for coming, and good morning. Jim, will you say and give us your full name, please?
James Brendan Fay.
And Jim, were you named after any member of the family?
Yes, my father.
Do you recall where and when you were born?
I was born in the Bronx on February 11, 1930.
Are there other members of your family?
Yes, I have a sister, Ann Griffin, who also worked here at the college for many years.
What were your parents' names and what did your father do?
My father's name was James, and he was a subway motorman in New York City. My mother's name was Margaret, and when she worked, she was a domestic.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us something about your early education? Where did you go to grade school?
I went to Our Lady of Assumption Grammar School in the Bronx.
Do you recall the years you went there?
Yes, I do.
Can you tell us those years?
I can remember many people that I met in later life, including Gus Nolan, who is now interviewing me.
So you went there from about 1936 or 35 to 43,
1936 to 1943.
Right, okay. And then what about high school? Where did you go to high school?
I went to Cardinal Hayes High School in the Bronx, New York. That was from 43 to 1947.
Okay. Let's switch a little bit and talk about your personal life. Well, when did you meet Pat and when did you get married?
I met my wife in 1947. We got married in 1953 at St. Benedict's Church in the Bronx, New York.
And do you have children?
Yes, we have seven children, six are still alive.
Okay, can you say something about where they are now?
The oldest girl, Patricia, lives in Los Angeles, California, and she's a nurse. My second oldest daughter, Kathleen, lives in Modena, New York, and she's a high school teacher. My third daughter, Colleen, lives in Melbourne, Florida. She's a nurse. My daughter, Erin, lives in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and she's a physical therapist. My daughter, Maureen, lives in Milford, Connecticut. She is a health consultant. My son, James, lives in Lansing, Michigan. He was a police officer for 6 years. He's now in law school.
Okay, fine. Let's come back to your education and graduate education, college and graduate. Where did you go to college?
My undergraduate I did at Fordham University, and I graduated in 1951. My graduate degree was an MBA from Siena in 1963.
Okay, did you do a military tour?
Yes, I did. I was in between my undergraduate and my graduate. From 51 to 55, I was a Supply Corps officer in the U.S. Navy, and I served at the submarine base in New London, Connecticut.
Did you ever go overseas?
No, I didn't go overseas, but I served with the submarine force there. I was there at the time we launched the first atomic submarine.
Okay.
I had many doings with Admiral Rickover.
Is that so? What about your work career? When did you start with IBM and how long were you there?
With IBM, I started in 1955 after I had left the service. I had 35 years of all kinds of diversified accounting experience at IBM. And I also did teaching at IBM. I taught many, many courses, both in the voluntary and management training programs for the IBM Education Department.
Were you always here on the East Coast with IBM?
Yes, I was.
Either in Kingston or Poughkeepsie?
I was in Kingston and Poughkeepsie and then back to Kingston again at the end of my career.
Okay. Let's talk about your teaching career at Marist. When did you come to Marist and how was that contact made?
I first came to Marist in 1964. I had gotten my MBA in May of 63 and I thought that I'd like to put it to some use. So I had sent out some resumes to some of the various colleges in the area. And in January of 1964, Brother Cornelius Russell, who at that time was the department chairman and the controller of the college, contacted me and said that there was an opening, they needed somebody in a hurry, that the teacher who had been teaching economics, who was an IBM and had left, he had taken another position down on Long Island. They need somebody quick. So down I came.
And what year was this now?
That was 1964.
1964. And Brother Cornelius was the controller at that time.
He was controller, and he was also the department chairman for the Department of Business.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the president at that time was?
To the best of my recollection, that was Brother Linus Boyd.
Uh-huh. Okay. When did Jack Kelly come on the scene? Do you recall his coming in?
I believe Jack came in 1963, which was about a year before I arrived. Brother Cornelius had been to a meeting in New York City of the American Economic Association, and he had been doing some surveying, if you will, for prospective candidates, and that's where he hired Jack. He met him down there, and he hired him in 1963.
Uh-huh. Okay. Let's come back to your teaching here. Were you always teaching basically the same course, or were there a number of courses that you were doing in accounting?
No, I taught quite a few courses. As a matter of fact, the first course I ever taught was a course in economics, because that's what the teacher who left was teaching, and I said, well, I don't know about that. And Jack Kelly said, well, as long as you keep one chapter ahead of him, you'll be fine.
All right.
So I taught that course. After that, I taught a course called Managerial Accounting, which is what they offered at that particular time, okay? As time evolved and we started offering accounting major, that's when we started expanding offerings, and that's when I started to teach some of the other courses. I also taught a course in financial management one summer, okay? But primarily, my teaching was always in the accounting field.
And would this have been one night a week or two nights a week? What was the time frame for that?
In the beginning, in the early days, it would be one night a week. And then it was changed, because what was happening was that they wanted to give the adults who were coming at night a better chance, a better opportunity to pick their courses. So initially, it was one night a week, and then it went to two nights a week.
Okay, and in the summer, it continued on?
I only taught in the summer on occasion. Usually it would be when some teacher would get either a grant or something and they couldn't teach, so they'd ask me to step in and help out. I usually like to take the summers off.
Right. When you would come here, do you recall the circumstances of the buildings? Where did you teach? Were you teaching in the Donnelly Building?
I have vivid memories of that. Everything was in Donnelly Hall. And as I say in my notes here, I can remember very well, you'd come out to go to class at night and you would meet the dorm students coming back from taking a shower because they were living in the same building. Everything was there. That was all we had was Donnelly Hall, and I believe the library was even that building, okay? But the students lived in that building. The food...
cafeteria was
right,
there?
They were living in that building, right? And it was sort of odd to see them coming down the hall with their robes on. There were no women students at that particular time.
Okay. These students, these were not just brothers now, these were lay students who had...
Lay students, and there came a time when I did have some of the scholastics, the brothers who were in the scholastic at that time.
Do you recall the spacious office arrangements that you had when you were teaching?
Well, of course, it was a small, knit group at that time, and it was small. The office space was shared by three adjuncts around a round table in the middle of an open space. The big shots had cubicles around their desk, but it was a very close and a very warm atmosphere. It gave us a chance to get to know everybody very well. Okay? And it was a mixture. It wasn't just the business department. It would be people there from other disciplines.
Okay, can you recall some of the people who were part of this close-knit group?
Oh, yes, I can remember. There was one.
Give me three.
George Duran, who taught, I believe it was economics. He left, and I believe he went to the University of Duquesne. And there was a fellow by a math teacher whose name just doesn't strike me right now, but I can remember a very funny incident happened one night where this particular fellow was teaching math said that he was a bachelor and he was in the area and he hadn't had an opportunity to really meet anybody of the opposing sex. And George said, well, gee, you know, I have a sister that lives down in Newburgh. And he took out a picture and he showed the picture and she had lay clothes on, you know, dressed up in civvies.
Yeah.
And then he said, I have a more recent picture, and he took out one and she was a nun. This guy really blew him up. So we We had a lot of banter back and forth.
And other departments, did you meet anybody in the English department or anybody?
Oh, yes. I can remember Dr. George Summers, okay?
Oh, you know George Summers?
Oh, yeah, I knew him very well. Yeah, uh-huh. I knew Kevin Donahue in philosophy, and Kevin Carolyn. In fact, a lot of nights on Monday nights, after we finished teaching, Kevin and the two Kevins would invite me down to Eden Place where the brothers were living at that time. We'd have a couple of beers and watch the Monday night football. My wife would want to know why the class was so late.
Yeah. It was on your breath. Tell me about the age of the students that you were teaching in those years.
Yes. In the early days, the majority of my students were IBMers who were taking advantage of the IBM tuition reimbursement program. They were older, they were serious students, and they were there to get an education, okay? Some of the students, if they started from the very beginning, would take them a period of about 9 years in order to get a bachelor's degree. And after 35 years at IBM, I wound up working for a manager who had in fact done that. I had had him in class years and years before that. And he had graduated from high school at 18 and went to IBM in like a tool builder's apprentice program. And then when they come out with the tuition program, he decided to go back to get a degree.
How big were the classes? Were they small classes or were they 25?
The average class was between 20 and 25. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And there weren't too many regular lay students from the college itself?
Very seldom. They would have to get special permission in those days to take the course at night. There would have to be some reason. Maybe they couldn't fit it in their schedule and daytime and they needed to graduate or something like that. But it was the exception rather than the rule, okay?
Right.
But the older students had a very definite effect on them, you know. They were almost like fatherly, you know what I mean? And the younger students said, well, we better do some work because these guys are serious.
Right. This was to change in some years down the line, was it not? When did you see a change come that more of the regular college would take the night classes? Was that 10 years after you were here or something like that? The early 70s,
yeah,
maybe?
The late 60s, early 70s, right.
Yeah.
I'd say definitely like during the Vietnam War time frame,
yeah.
You know.
Uh-huh.
There was a change of the more the day students came. There was an expansion of the enrollment of the college.
Well, eventually the dormitories went up and they moved them out of the Donnelly Hall, and the cafeteria was moved out, and they put classrooms down there.
Right.
So that all helped.
Yeah, that would be the time frame. And then we went through some turmoil in the 60s with the students, you know. It was an adjustment for some of us traditionalists to accept the long hair and what have you. But I finally had to resolve the fact that if it's clean, it's fine, okay?
And
as a matter of fact, I had one student who, some years later, I was sitting in my office and he came in one night. I didn't know who it was. I didn't recognize him. And he asked me if I would sign an affidavit. He was sitting for the CPA exam. And I said, I don't know if I know you. And he told me that, he said, the last time you saw me, I had dirty dungarees on. I was unshaven. I had long hair. And he told me who he was. And he said, I always remember you telling me that if I'm going to get any kind of a decent job, we're going to have to clean up my act.
Good. At what point in time did the female population begin to take courses with you?
It was sometime, I believe, in the later 60s. In fact, the first female to take courses here was a nun. She was a Benedictine nun from Benedictine Hospital in Kingston, New York. She was the controller up there. She came through, was an outstanding student. She was actually the valedictorian the year she graduated, but she declined it because she felt there might be an indication of some kind of favorism or something.
Yeah.
She later went on and got her MBA, and she is now the treasurer of her order down in New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
She's had some serious health problems, but
she must be on in years then.
Well, she had worked for the state tax department for the state of New Jersey for 14 years before she entered the Congress.
Wow, so that gives you a clue.
And in those days, they wore the full habit, if you know what I mean, and she had to come with a companion, and her companion was Sister Marie Paul, a short little nun, who just died last year. She was 91 years old. She was more well known around the college than Sister Teresa was. And at graduation, they gave her a little honorary diploma. Everybody knew her.
and the other female population, yes, the regular women coming, were they a distraction for your serious students?
No, the first lay person to come in here was Linda Foley. Her father-in-law, I believe, was a, I think he had a pretty good job at IBM at Poughkeepsie, and if I'm not mistaken, he was on the early board of trustees of the college here. Mm. But she came in, I'm not sure, it was sometime after Sister Teresa Paul was admitted to the college. They weren't a distraction, except I can remember one. We also had a contingent of state troopers here. The state police had a tuition reimbursement program, so we had a lot of state troopers from the Millbrook Barracks who were getting up in towards the end of their years, getting ready to retire, and felt that if they had a degree, that would help them when they got out to look for something else. And I can think of one who I turned out to be very friendly with. He would sit there next to, behind this Linda Foley, and she was a very attractive lady, yeah. I must admit that. And he would wink at me, and I knew what he was doing, and I would have to sort of go to the other side of the classroom not to be too distracted. John Salters was his name, a great person. He was the police chief up in Woodstock after he retired from the state police. He died several years ago, and as I say, I came very close to a lot of these students, and I've gone to a lot of funerals of my ex-students.
Yeah, I bet you have.
Some of them are very fine people, and that's one of the things that I enjoyed about the many years that I spent here, was that I met many, many fine people, among them students.
A quick mathematical thing would tell me you have thousands of graduates. I mean, if you had 25 or 30 students each semester for 30 years, that would really put it up into several thousand
students.
Oh, yeah.
I have all the records at home.
Well, you're an IBMer. You have that kind of personality. And an archivist next to me would generally be happy when you look at some of those things. Did the female students do as well in class in terms of the academic performance? Were they able to get the concepts that you were dealing with? Generally, they don't do well in math, but I was wondering whether you felt that way.
The early students, in particular the two women that I just addressed, were excellent students. Near the end of my career at the college, I would agree with you that the female students didn't get the concept as well as the males. Okay, I don't know why, but that's a true statement.
Yeah, okay. And
it might be due to a lack of interest, because near the end of my career, I was teaching financial and managerial accounting, and this was for the non-accounting majors. And a lot of these students were taking it to fill in the
requirements.
Yeah. And it may be that it was, well, I have to take it, you know what I mean, rather than something that they thought they were going to use. Although I try to convince them, it would help them balance their checkbook.
Yeah. And tell me about, in the span of your years here, would you say that the maturity of the students, the capability of the students, changed in any way, or are they fundamentally the same? Was it pretty much the same cut from the 1965 period to the 1995 period?
My general observation is that I've seen a decline in maturity. Uh-huh. From the early years to the later years, but that's my observation. Okay? There's still a lot of fine students out there, but overall, I would have to say on an average basis, I saw a decline in maturity.
Uh-huh. Well, your first students were generally maybe the first of their family to go to college,
and there was
the hunger to get it.
And I think some of it was due to the fact that the environment in which we live today, where I think in some cases there's a lot of parental pressure to have the child go to college, whether they want to go or not. And I know that to be a fact in some cases, and because of that, they don't take it too seriously, you know, and they're not mature enough to handle the situation.
Okay.
The lack of maturity, I find predominantly with the freshmen, and that's understandable because some of them are coming into a new environment, and they don't know how to handle the newfound freedom. You know?
Right, first time away from home and living on their own.
Right, some of that has to do with that.
Let's move on to other aspects of your work here. There's been changes in the buildings. Eventually, did you move from Donnelly? What was your next experience and facilities to be able to present your material?
We moved from Donnelly over to Dyson, okay? Mm-hmm. I never had any complaints about it. For the course that I taught, Donnelly was fine, okay? Dyson's a beautiful building, no question about it. But in terms of functional use, it was the same to me in both buildings. So.
You need a blackboard?
Blackboard, an overhead projector, you know, I wasn't teaching anything that required anything special where, you know, it would make a difference to go to Dyson Center.
Right. How about research materials? Were there times when the kids would complain about the lack of resources in the library, or was that not necessarily a part of what's involved in the counting?
It's not a part of the environment. Okay. Not in the courses that I was teaching. Some of the upper level courses it would be, but not in the courses that I was teaching.
Okay. From your perspective, looking around the campus, where would you say the most dramatic changes have taken place? I mean, because you know the Marion building, that it was now the gym, which then became a dormitory, and the building of the McCann Center, which is the recreational one. The putting up with the whole series of dormitories, Champagnat and Sheehan and Leo. The geographical changes on the body of the campus, what strikes you now as you come on here?
The building that we're sitting in right now, the library. Uh-huh. And as I mentioned to you before, this is my first time in the building, but it's unbelievable. I, you know, just from the outside, I can't imagine what's in here, but from the outside, it's a very striking building.
Okay? Yeah.
The other two buildings are very attractive. Lowell Thomas and Dyson certainly enhanced the overall plant.
Yeah. You saw the chapel going up. You saw me building that.
Oh, I certainly did. Yes, I remember the old Marist construction pew with 70 eaves.
And that brings me to if you can just touch your memory, some memorable events that you might have had here. Were you here for some of the dedications or some of the funerals or some of them?
The most recent dedication I came down to was the dedication of Fontaine for Brother Paul. Uh-huh. I was down for the dedication of a classroom in that building in memory of Tom Casey. Uh-huh. I was down for a dedication of a classroom in Dyson for my late brother-in-law, John Griffin. Uh-huh. And I was here for the one for... the other fellow, they have the building named after him. He was also an economics professor.
Kilgariff.
Kilgariff. Kilgariff.
So you've had more than just teaching experience here. You have come back because you
seem to tie-ins
to this institution. What do you think are some of the major assets that the college has going for it? When you consider where we were and where we are?
Well, there's no question about it. The physical plant stands out. I mean, what you see here today, 15, 20 years ago, I could not in my wildest dreams have imagined that it was going to turn out like this. You know? They've developed, I think, an excellent factory. They have a good variety of programs, you know. And they got a good location. You know, it's a place between New York City and Albany. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think those are the major contributions.
Were there, in your experience in the development of the various business and the master's program in business and so on, did you hear that from afar, how the thinking was going about this? Was this a part of meetings that you were at, or was that more in the Jack Kelly administration?
Yes, you have to remember the adjunct faculty was not a part of that. I could tell one funny little episode that back in the beginning, when I know in the early time, the adjuncts did have a vote. We would vote for a new department chairman, and they decided in those days that the adjunct would only be entitled to a half a vote. Well, we did that for a couple of times, and then they stopped it because they always knew who I voted for.
Okay. You did mention something, though, that and I had forgotten that for a moment, that John Griffin, your sister's husband who worked here, was there Was there a connection between you two also, along with Brother Cornelius was a friend of yours?
Right. What happened was I had been here for a couple of years teaching, and John was teaching at NYU in New York City, and he was wanting to get out of the city and move someplace. And Brother Cornelius told me that he was looking for somebody to teach economics. And so I said to him, would you mind if I have my brother-in-law put in a resume? And he says, sure. I said, put it in, I'll consider it. So that's what happened, and they hired him. Okay, I think it was back in the 60s sometime, 63, 64, something. Uh-huh. Oh, no, I must have been later, 65, 66 maybe. Uh-huh.
Okay. Did you ever have to deal with reports of times, or were you under supervision? Did people visit your classes, and did you ever have any kind of
Yes, in the early years, they used to come around and they would oversee the class, you know.
Sit in for a visit?
They would do it once a semester. But then in the later years, that sort of died out.
Well, they knew you could do it, so they spent time to visit other people.
No, but early on, they would do that. They would come in and make a spot check of the class. You know.
Okay. From your perspective, too, did you have an experience to know something about the leadership? You were here for Linus Hoy for a good number of years, and then there's a change to Dennis Murray. Was there any interaction on that high administrator level? Did you have to be at situations where they were present, or you see a difference, or what was your take on their administrative roles?
Well, I think with Foy, you know, he was here in the early years, and he developed and formulated a lot of the academic programs, along with putting up some of the physical plan. But then in 79, when Dennis came on board, there was no question about it that he expanded the physical plan and the academic offerings.
Yeah.
And I think Dennis really has put the college on the map. Okay.
Yeah. The public relations aspect of it, the name of it being out there, public opinion survey groups, MIPO, has made the thing. From your area in Kingston, do you hear anything about the college? Do you, is it frequented by the students? And
there's quite a few students from that area who come to Morris College. It has a good reputation.
Okay. Moving on to now where you are in your career of having just recently really retired full-time, or at least your position as the adjunct. Looking back, what's your take on the experience here? Do you think that, what was your contribution in terms of this development?
I honestly can't say that I made a major contribution to the college, but what I think I was able to do, because of my work experience, I was able to bring in practical application to the subject matter that I was teaching. I know that to be a fact because the students told me that, and they appreciate it, and they've come back years after I had them as a student and told me that that was a major thing to them, having been able to learn the practical side as well as the application of the theory. Okay?
I think you minimize your contribution. You think about the thousands of students that have gone through, and you filled a very important plug in terms of getting them.
Well, that was one of the reasons I stayed so long. I felt in some cases that maybe I was making a difference in their lives, and hoped that I did anyway.
Okay. Would you encourage someone else like you, like yourself, to do this?
Yes, I would. I think it's a tremendous experience. You know, I've enjoyed it. I've met many wonderful people, and as I say, in many ways, I think I got back more than I gave to the college over the years, and it was a very rewarding experience for me.
Well, that would have to be spelled out, because we didn't give you very much for coming. If I recall, the pay scale was something like minimal.
In the beginning, we got $200 for a course.
Don't say that out loud. But the Consumer Price Index now would say that we're worth about $30,000.
They would have to wait. After 35 years, I had to hire a truck to take me to the bank.
So it wasn't really the money. You found that there was a certain joy in doing it.
Well, I enjoyed doing it, and it was a rewarding experience. And maybe it's a little bit of the old ego, too, you know.
You're teaching at the college?
Yeah. Just be honest about it, you know.
Yeah.
It kicks your ego up a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. But it took some time at home, did it, on the weekends to prepare for that and do the corrections and how?
Well, in the beginning, yes, but over the years, you know, I got it down pretty good, so I didn't have to do too much preparation work. Most of the work was in correcting papers and doing the grading and coming up with averages and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But what I did was something I learned from Bishop Sheehan. Every semester I started from scratch. I threw all my notes out.
Uh-huh.
And I started over with a fresh set of notes. And that forced me to take a new look at the subject matter,
mm-hmm.
and make the changes that I wanted to make. But I never relied on a prior set of notes.
Uh-huh.
So I started from scratch every semester.
Uh-huh. But the subject was pretty much the same.
It was, but I wanted to take a fresh approach and not rely back on an old set of notes.
Uh-huh. And you said you made applications of the theory of accounting to real life?
Right. I would bring in examples. You know, we'd be talking about different things, and I would bring in a practical example of something that actually happened. And
could you give me a little example of that? I'm just curious as to, is it for banking or?
Well, okay, we're talking about internal controls, okay? Internal controls has to do setting up the proper procedures so that somebody doesn't deliberately steal your money or your assets or your resources, okay? And I gave them an example of an engineer that I knew that was a very fine gentleman. But unfortunately, him and his wife had gone their separate ways. He had five children and he ran into some financial difficulties. And so what was happening is he was an administrative assistant to one of the head engineers. Engineers in his area also played pinochle at lunchtime, and they didn't go over to the cafeteria. They would stay at their desk and play cards. And when they were doing a lot of traveling, he would say, look, I'll take your travel vouchers over to the cashier's cage, which is in the cafeteria, and I'll process them for you. And they'd say, sure, that's great. We don't have to go over there. We can continue on playing pinochle. Well, he got onto this idea that he could put in some phonies, because he knew the man numbers and all this stuff. So he was slipping some phony expense accounts in and taking the money. And that went along fine until one day he got a little sloppy and he put one in and he didn't put the man number, what we call the man number, on the document. It happened to be the last work day of the accounting period. He went upstairs to accounting and the girl was key punching with no man number, so she called the accountant. She said, look, you want me to get this in? We want to get out. It's Memorial weekend. You got to get a man number. So the guy said, well, all right, I'll call him up. So he called up the guy's name that was on the document.
Yeah.
And he said, what's your man number? And he gave it to him. And he said, what do you want to know for? He said, well, I traveled the thousand you put in. You didn't put your man number on it. He said, what are you talking about? I haven't made a trip in 6 months.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So make a long story short, about 15 of us accountants were in that weekend going through records. Make a long story short again, they found out that he had taken IBM for about $25,000. IBM wanted to go, we don't want to hear about that, right? Bad publicity. The bonding company said, you're prosecuting him or we'll drop all the bonding. So he was prosecuted in Ulster County Court and he did time.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But see, you know, unless you can bring something out of here, bring out the importance of why we have controls, or in that case we had a lack of controls, okay?
Yeah.
That should never have been allowed to happen, okay? And there was another case in Endicott where the guy was processing payroll records after somebody would be transferred from one location to the other. He would slip another card through there and then different things that happen, okay? So, but unless you're there and you see that actually happen, it's pretty hard for them to understand, what is this guy talking about?
Yes, right. I heard a similar story my brother told me about. In the military, a guy actually introduced a guy into the service, promoted him, sent him overseas, and discharged him over a period of years, you know, and picked his, you know, it was a virtual reality or something like that. That kind of thing. Well, let me ask you, kind of in the coming to a conclusion, since we're into storytelling now, and more practically, is there something that you would like to say that I didn't ask you? You know, thinking about your experience here and what do you see, do you think the college is going to be able to maintain this image that it has, or what was it going to have to do that? If you had to go to the Board of Trustees, what would be a message you might give them to maintain itself?
Well, this is maybe just a little on the subject. I've always like thought if they could come up with a, like in the school of management, they could come up with a school of accountancy or something like that of finance, a real specialty that would put them on the map. You know what I mean? It would take funding to do it. I won the mega lot, or maybe I could fix it.
Yes, yeah.
But I think something like that, I mean, they have a very good reputation, but something that would make them different than everybody else. Oh, there it is, that's that school of accountancy up there in Marist College, you know, or finance, whatever it is, okay?
That's so we, even within the business program and in the MBA program, there seems to be a focus that has to be developed yet.
Yeah, right.
That would
even if it would have to be that they were known as a school that specializes in forensic accounting or something like that. With all this things going on in the field of accounting today, that might be a very appropriate field.
Well, on that happy note, Jim, I'll say thank you very much. It's been a delight talking to you.